The Monsters That Made Us is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all things movies, music, media, monsters, and more, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. Today we're heading back to Cairo, nearly a decade after Rick and Evie sent the evil Imhotep back to the underworld and saved the world from total annihilation. Well, Imhotep is back, having been resurrected by a mysterious cult led by a museum curator, of course, and a reincarnated Ankh-Senamun, and now he's headed to Amshir, an oasis hidden in the desert with the goal of defeating the fabled Scorpion King, gaining control of Anubis's army, and taking over the world. Again. Along with him is Rick and Evie's son, Alex, who possesses the Bracelet of Anubis, which contains the location of Amshir, and it's up to Rick, Evie, Jonathan, and Ardeth Bay to once again race against time and across continents and deserts, through canyons and jungles, by land, sea, and air, while fighting off waves of cultists and pygmy mummies to rescue their son, defeat the Scorpion King, and send Imhotep back to the underworld for good. Also, Evie is revealed to be a reincarnated Nefertiti, and Rick might be a Magi. You got all that? Fire up your dirigible and prepare for more whirlwind adventure than you can shake a stick at as we discuss The Mummy Returns.
To a new world of gods and monsters.
Listen to them. Children of the night.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
You're crazy to know who I am, aren't you? I'll show you who I am and what I am.
I tell you, I killed a wolf, a plain, ordinary wolf.
By studying these and other species, we add to our knowledge of how life evolved, how it adapted itself to this world.
He went for a little walk. He didn't see his face.
Welcome to the return of The Monsters That Made Us, the podcast where we celebrate the spooktacular characters and films in the Universal Studios Classic Monsters series. Today we'll be discussing the first sequel to Stephen Sommers' 1999 Mummy film, The Mummy Returns. I'm the Invisible Dan Colon, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, who wouldn't surprise me if he was a Magi as well. It's Monster Mike Manzi. How are you, Mike?
I am no Magi, I tell you that much, but I sit in my airship ready to go again.
Well, after his first swing at resurrecting Imhotep for the modern era was such an overwhelming success, a sequel was greenlit immediately. Writer-director Stephen Sommers got to work on a script, and not only was he able to retain the entire principal cast, but the entire crew from the original Mummy came along for the ride as well. And together, they set out to make a sequel that was bigger, bolder, and more action-packed, but also more scary and less broad than its predecessor. With the addition of a new villain, a massive army, and what feels like a non-stop barrage of action set pieces from start to finish, it's difficult to argue that they didn't succeed in that goal. But here's the question. Was it too much? What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, Dan, wow. Coming back to revisit this one was kind of a shock. Several major things were going on around this time in Hollywood, but something big can't be ignored as we start this movie, and it is The Lord of the Rings.
Yep.
And I just feel like Stephen Sommers Middle-earthed this crap and was all about expanding lore and setting up multiple epic movies and an entire universe. Some of which we'll get back to, but most of which is what we get here. So yeah. I didn't factor that in the first time I watched this movie, and I quite enjoyed it. I think for a sequel, it ramps everything up. It drives like the energy up. Everything is just pumped up more. But watching it again this time, I realized there's kind of a detriment to that, and it's a little over the top. It's a little incoherent. I mean, it's all these things, right? It's overblown. The special effects have gotten out of control. I mean, everything just seems like it's out of control. Although I also feel like Stephen Sommers knows exactly what he's doing, but he might be the only one that knows what he's doing. Regardless, I still had a lot of fun. There's a lot of really, really cool stuff going on here, but I just feel like there's way too much going on. I mean, it feels like we're missing like almost an entire first act. Like we got to get in there and start right away. So we're dropped into the action. But again, like lots of cool stuff, but also lots of head scratching and lots of things around like there's multiple movies going on right now.
Yep.
Let's just try and tell one at a time if we can. So maybe next time. But for what we got, like, yeah, it was an exhaustive watch, but you know, ultimately, like, still, it's still fun. I mean, it's a mummy. The Mummy Returns. I wasn't really expecting anything else.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. It's still fun because, you know, all the characters that we love from the original movie are back, and I'm always gonna have a good time watching a movie with every one of those characters involved, especially when they're all played by the original actors. And so we'll see if that holds true when we get to Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, because I know Rachel Weisz did not come back. She was replaced with Maria Bello. So yeah, we're gonna get Evie, but it's not gonna be the Evie that we're familiar with. Yeah, it's still a lot of fun. A lot of these set pieces are really enjoyable to watch. But largely, I feel like this movie is, it's like Stephen Sommers crafted a narrative to support all of the action scenes he wanted to do. I mean, he even said at one point, I think in one of the Blu-ray extras, that like, I'm making an adventure movie. Let's throw everything at the wall and the kitchen sink. He literally came at it with that approach, and it definitely feels like that. Any little thing he wanted to cram into this movie, he found a place for it. And as a result, the narrative suffers. I think the plot here, we talked a lot about how simplistic and brilliant that first Mummy movie was. And here it's like, okay, the plot is going to be secondary to everything else. As a result, I had to like take very meticulous notes just to follow the plot. I think I watched it 3 times just to understand all of the ins and outs of what was going on.
This is like the opposite of the first movie, where this movie needs to like take a pill and slow down and like maintain a certain pace and like realize, you know, there's scenes, there's action scenes, then there's like exposition scenes, and then there's like other types of scenes. And this movie is only concerned with action scenes, and like that's fine for what it is, but like it feels very convoluted and nonsensical because you're right, like he's writing for the action instead of the opposite way around. And so none of it feels very natural. And so when you're in the middle of an action scene and it's kind of like, why are we here? And Rick suddenly got this tattoo we've never heard of. It's like, no.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. These details that should have been introduced in the first movie.
Or the first act of this one, which we don't get.
Right. I remember Rick had a hand tattoo in the first movie, which I think is completely gone in this one, replaced with the wrist tattoo that suddenly has very significant meaning. So, like, that's some sloppy storytelling. The whole Evie is Nefertiti and suddenly has wicked fight skills. Why didn't she have those abilities in the first movie? Like, I feel like so many of these details were crammed in here, and it makes for sloppy continuity.
Yeah, definitely, because like all they really needed to do is drop a line about her mother's ancestry, like in the first movie. Like, we're aware that there might be some lineage here, but you got to say something in this movie. You can't be like, oh, by the way, I'm having these visions. It's like, no. And like, I love the whole, like, make the movie that her and the Aksunama storyline. That's plenty.
Yep.
You know, we almost don't need little Alex. We don't need Rick's tattoo, even though it's cool. We definitely don't need the Scorpion King here, but we'll get to that. I mean, that's a whole other realm that we're dealing with here. But you know, you're right. If Evie can do these things, what about Jonathan? Why isn't he able to do any kind of secret hidden skills passed down to him over the ages and stuff? But yeah, so it's nuts. Like, it just I like it, but like, it's craziness what's going on here sometimes.
Yeah, it definitely feels like Stephen Sommers, I mean, that first go around, he didn't know he was going to be making a sequel. It wasn't until after the movie was released that they were like, okay, yeah, we're going to make another one. And it definitely doesn't feel like he had a third movie in mind, because he's all gas, no brakes in this sequel. He didn't leave anything on the table, nothing in the tank for, you know, the story to continue. And of course, he didn't come back to direct Tomb of the Dragon Emperor. And we'll get into that in that episode. But I guess he didn't think there was going to be anything beyond this and just let it all out.
Which is crazy to me, because like I mentioned earlier, it's got such a Lord of the Rings setup with the intro and stuff, where it's like, where else could this go next but to a Scorpion King movie? It's like, I don't know. To me, it felt like he was laying groundwork. Like, I got like 5 of these in me. And so it's so strange. It does feel like he got this urge that he's not going to get the chance to make more, but clearly you're going to get the chance to make more. So it just, either he was kind of, I'm running on empty, this is all I got left, or the studio wanted to do like other directions with the material, because it doesn't seem like there was any lack of ideas going on here.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I can't really shed any light on that because I wasn't able to find a ton of information about The Mummy Returns. Everybody came back, so it pretty much happened the way you would assume this sequel was made, right? Like, none of it's surprising.
Yeah, they probably didn't even, like, break down all the sets from the last movie yet.
I know that they pretty much began immediately. Just like that first Mummy, they shot a bunch of it in Morocco. This time, they were also able to shoot in Jordan and in Egypt. And, of course, they shot a lot of stuff in England, back at Pinewood and Shepperton Studios. And they're also working with ILM again for all the special effects. Again, combining practical effects with state-of-the-art digital effects. I say state-of-the-art digital effects, but it definitely feels like they were rushing to get this one into theaters, and some of these effects don't really feel finished.
Yeah, if this is ILM, their A-teams are over on the prequels right now, you know, doing that kind of stuff.
And Star Wars, yeah.
Yeah, and with the Lord of the Rings and like King Kong and all that, I feel like it's the Weta Digital Workshop is coming up into their own for the next 10 years. They're going to kind of become like a big name next to ILM. And I don't think they're anywhere on this project either. So it does seem like they're getting a little shafted with the digital pipeline.
Definitely. So beyond that, I don't really have any notes on the production here. So we can just dive right into the cast and crew. We don't have to get into everybody we've already talked about on our previous Mummy episode. We'll just touch on them. James Jackson, Sean Daniel, once again, producing this one. Steven Summers, writing and directing. Brendan Fraser plays Rick O'Connell, Rachel Weisz as Evelyn, John Hannah is back as Jonathan Carnahan, Arnold Vosloo as Imhotep, Odette Fehr as Ardeth Bey, and Patricia Velasquez gets a fleshed out role here. She plays a double role, both as this character Mila, whose name I don't think is ever said out loud. It's in the credits, so that's how I know her name was Mila, but she's also the reincarnated Ankh Senaman. So that's everybody from the original movie that came back. The new cast here, we've got Freddie Booth as Alex O'Connell. He didn't have a huge acting career, so there's not a ton of history to get into. He basically did some movies as a kid and then eventually transitioned out of that and into a career in marketing and advertising. Apparently, he was originally offered a role in Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. I don't know what character, but he turned that down to do The Mummy Returns instead.
I was thinking Harry Potter with this kid the entire movie. You know, I was like, where's me wizard mom? And like all that kind of stuff. I almost wondered if he should have been their kid. We'll get into it later, but I have very mixed feelings, not about the actor. I think the kid did a good job, but just like the purpose of this character.
I think I'm kind of with you on that. In his teens, he did do some work on television. He appeared in the 2010 miniseries Pillars of the Earth, as well as the 2013 Nickelodeon series House of Anubis. How about that?
Hey.
Next up is Dwayne The Rock Johnson making his feature film debut as the Scorpion King.
Wow. Yeah, this I definitely remembered. I remembered him in the beginning and remember waiting the entire movie for him to come back as this completely twisted and terrifying Uncanny Valley scorpion monster here at the end.
I think I heard he shared top billing for this one, even though he's only in the first 10 minutes, really. The rest is all CG, maybe motion capture performance probably, but the only real work he did on this movie was in the opening prologue. Because he was The Rock, he got like crazy billing,
and he will get his own movie. Like, he's coming back. Like, we're seeing him again. As far as like the character to Scorpion King, we're really seeing him again.
Dwayne Johnson, of course, began his career in the World Wrestling Federation in 1996 after his pro football career failed to take off. He skyrocketed to stardom during the WWF's Attitude Era, and before long, he was ready to try his hand at the movie business as well. After The Mummy Returns, he reprised his role in 2002's The Scorpion King, as we discussed, then spent the last two decades racking up a list of movie and television credits, way too long to list here, but today, Johnson is among the highest grossing and highest paid actors in the world. So how about that for career trajectory?
Yeah, really, but also kind of like the franchise destroyer. I look at his career and I'm like, man, he's got all these great opportunities, and then every time he gets there, it's like the end of the road for whatever he's working on, you know?
I still maintain he is the third best actor to come out of the WWF. Dave Bautista is my number one, and then John Cena, number two. Cena doesn't have a great range, but he has a really great sense of how he is perceived and chooses really great roles for himself, whereas Dwayne Johnson is kind of always Dwayne Johnson in whatever it is he does.
I definitely hear you on that. Getting wrestling actors is kind of it's few and far between. It seemed to be more of a gimmick back in the day when like Hulk Hogan would show up in a movie or do his no holds barred. But yeah, I definitely love what John Cena's been doing with Peacemaker.
Alan Armstrong plays Baltus Hafez, the museum curator. I don't think we really hear his name mentioned at all throughout this movie. We just kind of know him as the museum curator who's also the leader of a secret cult. How about that for throwing it back to the original Mummy franchise? It's always those museum curators.
Or the last movie. It's just like now this time the bad cult is at like another museum.
Yeah.
They stake their claim. It's like, you know, only one cult per museum, please.
Armstrong is a prolific English actor. Like all British actors, he started on the stage before eventually transitioning to the screen. In the early 70s, he began juggling TV and film work in addition to the theater and has continued to do so ever since. His feature film debut was 1971's Get Carter, starring Sir Michael Caine. And he has since appeared in A Bridge Too Far, The Duelists, Patriot Games, and Braveheart. And we will see him again when we eventually get to Van Helsing.
Yeah, I'm familiar with this guy for sure. I remember seeing him like my entire life.
Adewale Akinoye Agbaje plays Lakna. He's an English actor born to Nigerian parents who decided to give him up to a white working class family when he was just 6 weeks old. He earned a master's in law at King's College London before being introduced to the world of modeling, which ultimately brought him to Hollywood, where in 1995 he made his film debut in Congo. From there, he has appeared all over the place, showing up in Ace Ventura When Nature Calls, Oz.
Oz, Adebisi, that's where I knew him from. Yep. Scared the hell out of me when I was younger. And then Lost as Mr. Echo, like such a great presence.
Also The Bourne Identity, Thor the Dark World, Suicide Squad, Game of Thrones, and his Dark Materials. Incredible actor. I love when he shows up in things. He's always really fun to watch. I don't love the kid who plays Alex in this, but I love watching Adewale act opposite him in all of their scenes together.
Yeah, they're great together. And then at the end when he's like, I finally get to kill that kid? All right. And like that, it's his whole arc. They're fun. You're right. I like him in this. I think he's a good addition into like the entire cast, and he would have fit perfectly in the last movie as well somewhere, as you know, so felt like a very natural addition.
Sean Parks plays Izzy. He's another English actor of stage and screen. He made his film debut in a 1999 British coming-of-age comedy called Human Traffic and has since done a lot of British television. He was in a great two-part episode of Doctor Who, that much I know. Most of his career, of course, has been spent in the UK, with The Mummy Returns being the only real Hollywood film of his filmography. And then we've got the three sort of like mercenary characters. Bruce Byron plays Red Willits, Joe Dixon as Jax, and Tom Fisher as Spivvy. We've got a great score by Alan Silvestri. He composed the whole score to Back to the Future, and he does a lot of the Marvel stuff now. Cinematography, you know, somehow I missed this in our first Mummy episode, but we have the same cinematographer. It's Adrian Biddle. Adrian Biddle was an English cinematographer who first broke into the film industry back in 1967 as an apprentice underwater photographer, working in an uncredited capacity on Her Majesty's Secret Service. He eventually worked up to clapper loader on Ridley Scott's The Duelists and then focus puller on Alien before getting called up to shoot Aliens for James Cameron after the original cinematographer Dick Bush left the film due to creative differences with Cameron.
Yeah, he wanted more tea time from what I understand.
Before his untimely death in 2005, Biddle worked as cinematographer on a number of films that we love, including The Princess Bride, Willow, Thelma and Louise, Judge Dredd, Event Horizon, The World Is Not Enough, Rain of Fire, and V for Vendetta.
Nice. Awesome career.
That's it for cast and crew. The Mummy Returns was released on May 4th, 2001, and grossed $435 million worldwide, outgrossing the original Mummy movie. Another massive success, of course. And as we've sort of talked about, we get another Mummy sequel, and then the Scorpion King gets his own movie and franchise. This was a big hit in 2001. I do have a couple odds and ends that I discovered, nothing right. Super important. A couple fun facts. So The Rock, when he was on set for that opening battle sequence, apparently he was suffering from food poisoning through a lot of that. So kind of like Harrison Ford shooting Raiders of the Lost Ark, doing the scene through the town square when he like shoots that sword wielder. He had like a fever that day. The Rock similarly battled through illness to shoot a whole battle scene. The elements, once again, were causing problems. This one was plagued with sandstorms, thunderstorms, flash floods, often ruining complete days of shooting. I know some of the scenes in there, they had to completely replace the sky. The bridge sequence, when they're in London, the local authorities in London had to shut down the that whole area, which is a major artery through London. They were only allowed to really shoot on the bridge for 10 minutes at a time so they could let traffic go through. So also kind of cool, The Mummy Returns was at the time the fastest selling DVD ever in the United States, with 2 million copies being sold after its first week.
Oh, wow. Yeah, this was in like the infancy of DVDs. Everyone testing out their new televisions with this movie.
That's all I got for, you know, behind the scenes stuff for The Mummy Returns. So let's just dive in. We talked about all the action in this, right? So what I did was I thought it would be interesting to sort of track this movie by the action scenes. Overall, I discovered that there are 9 separate action scenes.
Wow.
So you're averaging about an action sequence every 13 minutes or so. And that includes like the 20 minute finale. I kept that all as one action sequence.
Yeah. And that has like multiple things going on, like the end of a Star Wars movie, where there's like 3 things happening between all the different players at the same time that are cross cutting between.
Yeah, so that's like 3 action scenes all combined to make one big one. For our purposes, we'll count it as one big one. Okay, so the movie opens in Thebes once again. This time it's in the year 3067 BC, and we get the whole prologue about the Scorpion King as told to us by Ardeth Bey. Essentially, we have this character, the Scorpion King. We don't know a whole lot about him. This is sort of what you were referring to earlier about how like we could have used some more exposition. All we know is that he's this Scorpion King guy with an army.
We even get a voiceover, and the voiceover doesn't really know where he's from or anything. He's just like, the Scorpion King like came out of the desert one day and he had Anubis's army and he just started kicking everyone's ass. And everyone was like, what? Where the hell did this guy come from?
He doesn't get the Anubis army yet. He and his men are on this campaign to just take over everything, right?
Yeah, he's like some kind of Attila the Hun he's just a warlord at first.
But at the end of a 7-year campaign, he is the only one still left alive, and he's basically wandering the desert. On the verge of death, he makes a pact with the god Anubis. You know, he will serve him in exchange for the army so he can conquer his enemies and so on and so forth. That is where the genesis of Amshir happens. This like oasis magically springs up out of the desert. Anubis's army of like jackal men shows up and they just tear ass through town and completely obliterate everything. And at the end of that, Anubis comes to collect, and the Scorpion King essentially becomes his slave. That's the end of the Scorpion King for now.
Yeah, so seems like a bit of like a bad deal for the Scorpion King, you know, if like he can't hang out and rule for a while, like Anubis is going to come collect immediately and like turn him into this creature, lock him behind some door and shuffle him away in some oasis where they lose the map to again. It becomes a fairy tale. I didn't know Anubis had this army. Like from everything I've heard about the guy, he deals with the afterlife.
Right.
I guess if you offered up like all of these souls to him, that would be one thing, but he is just kind of like, give me your army, give me your power, and suddenly a bunch of the jackal men appear out of nowhere and that's his army. And then you get like this crazy battle between the jackals and the humans, and it's just like mind-blowing to be like, this happened in the movie? Like this like according to the lore of the mummy world? That is what's wild to me, is like, it seems like such a bigger incident than the mummy rising.
Yes.
In the first place, that like they'd be more concerned about the Scorpion King rising than the mummy rising. I understand they want to raise the stakes and they want to go bigger, but it almost seems like they overshot.
Well, they raised the stakes in the past. And so now we have to like sort of retcon everything so that everything in the present feels legitimate.
Because it's not even like we need to stop the mummy. It's like we need the mummy to stop the Scorpion King, and then we got to figure out what to do with the mummy.
Well, I will say that, you know, it comes to mind that at some point in the movie, I think Ardeth Bey probably mentions it because he's kind of the walking exposition in this movie. He mentions that Imhotep at full power is the only one strong enough to defeat the Scorpion King.
Which turns out to be untrue, because we find out that Rick is a secret member of some ancient organization that also has the gift to, we'll get there.
Yes. Yes. And we also at that point don't know that Imhotep will be stripped of his power in order to fight the Scorpion King, right? He has to fight as a mortal. So we don't know that yet. But I mean, it does feel like a bigger threat, but at the same time, Imhotep is a sort of established as the bigger threat than the Scorpion King. I don't know. If you're going to introduce a new character, it should be a bigger threat. It just feels sloppy.
Yeah, like we're here, we're stuck with it, we're going to move forward. Like, that's fine. I accept it. It's ultimately big action blockbuster movie stuff. So like, I'm not looking for the sophistication that surprised me last time. But we really, like, in my mind, only need the mummy. Like, you go back and you tell another story about Imhotep did before he was mummified, you know, be like 5 years before that happened, like he made a pact with someone and like everyone forgot about that, you know, but like now he needs it because he was defeated by Rick in the future and this and that and stuff. And so like, I feel like there's a way to do this without the Scorpion King, especially with Aksunama like walking around in modern day, figuring stuff out and how to bring him back. And in retrospect, it was like another one of those details that wasn't necessary. You just do all that Scorpion King stuff and you give it to Imhotep and be like, no, he's also like the king of scorpions as well as the mummy.
I don't know what the solution is. I don't know that I necessarily have the answer, but all I know is, like I said, it feels sort of half-baked, but you know, they had to get the Rock in there. So we fast forward to 1933. It's about 9 years or so since the events of the previous movie. I think the timeline there is a little bit off. They say 9 years.
They say Alex is eight.
It says 1933. The original Mummy jumps forward to 1926. So the entire adventure from that first movie is 1926. So this is really like 7 years. But right. Alex is definitely older than like six or seven.
Hey, this isn't going to be the first time that this Alex O'Connell has slipped through some sort of time vortex and emerged the other side too old.
Like, I'm not going to make a big deal out of it, but I wanted to make sure that I wasn't crazy. It definitely felt like there wasn't like 10 years passing. And the timestamps that we get in this movie and in the previous movie don't add up to 9 years. But Alex is about 9 or 10. So anyway, we catch up with the O'Connells. They're still like tomb raiding once again.
Surprised me that we don't get any setup at their mansion being like, Alex, come on, like get ready. And he's like fussing with one of their ancient, you know, relics. And maybe he's in the library and they do sort of like a clumsy thing to be like, oh, you're just like your mom, but then also you're just like your dad. We get it kind of later, but like I was very surprised and I totally forgot that this movie is just going to drop us like right in the center of a tomb raid. And it kind of feels like they might have shot an entire half hour and just thrown it out, because it feels like we're jumping into the middle of a second act or something here when this gets started. And there's a little something refreshing about it, but I was just kind of thrown off guard because I was like, where's all this setup? There's no setup in this one whatsoever. We're going to get it as we're going.
Yeah. And I'm okay with that. I kind of like that. We're like just kind of thrown back into another adventure. The way it's cut together, our introduction to Alex is a pretty solid jump scare. I like the whole reintroduction.
I think Rick looks great. You know, there's going to be a fun shot when they come home and he's wearing like an actual fedora.
Right. It's the sort of silhouette intro of Rick very much feels like Indiana Jones. It's a cool little tomb raid sequence. Evie starts to experience her visions. She starts to see into the past, visions of Aksunaman and some of the details that will become relevant later. Within this raid, they discover the bracelet of Anubis. They don't entirely know what it is just yet. They know it is the bracelet of Anubis, but that's about it. There's a whole set piece with Alex and these three mercenaries who've been hired by the cult, which we will find out shortly. They've been sent to retrieve the bracelet of Anubis so that they can eventually find Amshir. But the O'Connells, through a whole like action scene, manage to escape and get back to London. So that's two action scenes so far, if we're keeping track.
I found the Evie stuff pretty interesting. Like, I was like, oh, this is where we're going to go. Like, I'm kind of cool with this. I wish we talked a little more about it at the start of the movie. We get a lot into, you know, her visions and why and all that kind of stuff later. But I was like, oh, this is kind of a cool mystery. There's a theme of kind of reincarnation with the mummies. And she had been kind of like tapped in the last movie by the mummy. Her soul has been like, whatever, you know, like I feel like something, whatever was done like in the last movie might have unlocked some kind of latent memory or power in her. I like this big underwater trap in this one, right? And they almost drown to death, which is kind of like thrilling. I will say, though, I'm starting to see that Brendan Fraser isn't going to be moving quite as much or as fast as the last movie. I think that it's already kind of hit him, the back problems or things like that, because Rick is moving a bit slower.
I definitely noticed that as well. I also noticed in this scene, like the sort of the visual continuity of this tomb collapsing and the columns having a domino effect like the bookcases in the first Mummy, which was pretty cool. I found out that they shot that over the course of like 5 days. I think that for the bookcases, they had to do all in one take, but with these columns, they shot it 5 different times for various reasons. They had to keep resetting and reshooting. But yeah, I loved the visual continuity there.
When we get back to their mansion, is that Wayne Manor? It looks so much like a Wayne Manor to me. I was like, awesome.
It definitely looks like one. We're not quite there in the story. We're almost there, but I heard that Brendan Fraser thought it would be a better idea to have the O'Connells in like a nice London apartment rather than a big mansion. Like they've just been finding these rare artifacts and selling them and getting rich that way. I think he was a bigger fan of like an apartment. And I think that they were going to try doing that, but finding a place to shoot was more trouble than it was worth. So they ended up using this mansion that they had access to. And that's kind of how that worked out. And I think the mansion was also the location they used for the interiors of the museum in the first movie, if I'm not mistaken.
I actually kind of like that bit because it feels so unlike them to own a mansion.
Yes, I agree.
Especially Rick. However, it's kind of funny, this idea of like, we have all this stuff that we're finding, like we got to send it somewhere. And they just found like a huge house to store all of their stuff in until it could be like appraised or shipped off to like some other corner of the world. Like they show up there and there's like this incredible clutter about it to be like, oh, well, these guys are just like hoarding.
So before we get back to England, we do get introduced to this cult. They don't really have a name.
They're digging up the buried city of the dead.
Yes, they're back at Hamunaptra excavating, I guess, the corpse of Imhotep.
Yeah, they're looking for the books. They want all like the trinkets, and then they like yank him out in some kind of crazy chrysalis, I guess, because he was like burned into the Well of Souls or some shit. And like his corpse is like all twisted inside of this like crazy rock formation.
It's a super cool scene. I like how this particular cult was kind of prepared for everything. I mean, they acquire pretty much all of the different mummy paraphernalia from the first movie, the Book of the Dead, the chest that it comes in.
They even have the mummy's black robes with his cool mask, like they're gonna give that back to him.
Okay, so I love how the scarabs come, you know, exploding out of the sand, and there's a really cool kill where one of these cultists, they're crawling through his skin like we've seen before, and then they explode out of his mouth. That was like maybe the coolest death I've seen in this movie. But for the most part, they're prepared for these scarabs because there's a couple flamethrowers involved. Yep. So yeah, these guys generally are hip to how to handle Imhotep. So we are also introduced to Mila, who is once again played by Patricia Velasquez. We know her as Ankh-Sennamon, and that is, figure that's going to come into play at some point. I don't think they ever really say that she's the reincarnation of Ankh-Sennamon.
He enlightens her at one point. He's like, I think he says, you might not realize you are Ankh-Sennamon, like reincarnated. And she's like, I think, yeah. She's like, I think I picked up on that.
That's where we get the flashback with Nefertiti and like the Well of Souls or whatever.
Yeah, and we're gonna get a really quick scene of her soul being reunited into her. But like, I'm just glad that she's here as a new major character, because I think that was my gripe in the last movie. I was like, we only have Evie running around. Like, it would be great if we had like a foil for Evie. And here we do. We have like evil Evie with Ankh-Sennamon and her vessel. And I think that this actress does a great job of being one of those very kind of like threatening, like whip cracking kind of dominatrix-ish kind of thing, you know, like I get that from her a lot. Definitely the person in charge without any question.
Yeah, she's super cool. And I think her acting experience was pretty limited, but I think she does a pretty solid job here, kind of doing a lot with a little. She, you know, she's got kind of a reserved performance.
And kind of an action performance too, though, because her and Evie throw down a couple times, and like, I buy it. I buy, you know, especially the one that takes place in the past, that Psy fight or whatever. Yes. Like, I thought that was exceedingly well done. I mean, I think they're wearing masks and stuff, but like, still, just conceptually for the character, I think they did a good job of finding a way to bring her back.
Okay, so moving on, we follow the O'Connells back to their home, which we discussed. It's in England. Basically, it looks like Wayne Manor. They are kind of unloading from their trip. While Rick and Evie are sort of engaged with each other, Alex discovers this bracelet of Anubis and just puts it on and is treated to like a holographic projection, but I think only he can see it.
Yeah.
Essentially, it reveals the path to Amshir.
He's also started some kind of timer where he's got like 5 days to get there or he's going to die.
Well, he doesn't know yet, but yeah, he has 7 days from the time he puts it on.
I like how they added that because it's like, wait, it's this little kid? That's the one fun thing I think about Alex being a child and like not putting it on Jonathan instead or something is that like multiple times in this movie, they're like, no, this kid's going to die. Like,
right.
There's a very real chance, if not from this curse, like one of these cultists is going to chop his head off or like the mummy's going to suck his soul out or the Scorpion King is going to eat him.
Speaking of Jonathan shows up. He's basically been treating the O'Connell house as his own bachelor pad.
That's such a great character. That's so like him where he's like, yeah, this is my house and all my stuff. And like, yeah. I'm actually the guy who killed the mummy and all that shit.
He's got this beautiful date. He's also got in his hand, he has got this gold scepter, which will come into play later. We don't really know where he found it, but of course Jonathan found it. He also found the key and the map to Hominoptera in the first movie. He's just the guy who, you know, in spite of his ineptitude, manages to like find the important shit always. I think it's his own greed that keeps him, like, he knows where those things are, like throughout the movie. If you watch him, he always knows like how to get that scepter back. And
yeah, he's like a magnet or a conduit for those kinds of things. And thank goodness this scepter keeps switching hands back to him because they really needed it at the end of the movie.
Yes, but we don't know that yet. The cult has tracked down the O'Connells at their home, and then this is the third fight scene or third action scene of the movie. It's a sword fight, firefight kind of scene. This is where Evie discovers that she can fight really well all of a sudden.
Well, she has to like trance out a little bit. Can't just like pick up a sword and like go at it, really. She has to like have kind of like a moment and like a headache.
Yeah.
Just like realize, wait a minute, I'm in the past right now and here come my abilities. I wish there was a little more here of like picking up crazy stuff to fight with, you know, just because like their house is so filled with like insane items and instead they kind of just have like the candlestick
there's a bunch of swords.
Yeah, there's a bunch of swords, but I mean, like, why not grab like an umbrella or grab something crazier? You know, like a tusk or I don't know. I just thought like maybe Rick would have found like some kind of crazier weapon or something along his travels. It just seemed like an opportunity to kind of like, if we're in this house of tricks, like let's pull out a few more tricks instead of everybody jumping out of a window again at the end.
I hadn't thought about it while I was watching it, but you're right. There were potentially some more avenues for more diverse fight sequences.
Yeah, just for some gags.
Yeah. We're also reunited with Ardeth Bay. We get a glimpse of him back at the canyon where they're digging up Imhotep. Here he finally like is reunited with the O'Connells. After the ensuing firefight, sword fight, Evie is kidnapped. She's taken to the British Museum, and then it's up to Rick and Ardeth Bay to rescue her.
Yeah, is this where Ardeth Bay mentions Rick's tattoo?
Yes.
For the first time, he's like, Rick, my friend, where did you get that tattoo? And he's like... Dude, this blew my mind. It's like, I need 30 minutes for this, what he's about to say. And he's just going to say it and forget it. He goes, oh, that thing, I got that slapped on me when I was in an orphanage as a little kid because I had no parents and stuff like that. And they just gave this to me. I was like, wait, what? You were in some kind of weird secret orphanage when you were a kid and they tattooed you? What? And then he's just like, oh, okay, whatever. And Ardeth Bay's like, no, like, I think we're related. And he's like, later, man, later. And I'm like, no, now.
They pretty much throw it away. Like, Rick was probably raised by Magi, not knowing who they were.
Yeah, and they like trained him for this moment, you know, and that's why he's such a badass. And he's like, no, I'm just a badass. He's like, no, like, this is destiny. And he's like, whatever.
He is a little bit too superhuman in that fight scene, though. There's a specific moment where somebody like throws a knife at him and he catches it in the air and then throws it back like Jack Burton.
On the reflexes.
it's suddenly this action hero that I enjoyed kind of watching him get beat up is now this like superhero. And I never really loved that, except with Jack Burton, where he drank a mysterious potion that gives him superhuman abilities. It's a weird arc that now he's a Magi.
And I just want to say, I'm only weirded out by it because we never flesh it out. Like, right. If this was going to be a plot point that we spend time with and, like, take seriously, like, that's cool, man. Like, mysterious birthmarks and people finding out they're the one, like, happens all the time. Like, I wouldn't mind that to be part of the plot, okay? But it's just, like, there's so many other things already laid out. I couldn't believe, like, I definitely never remembered that from, like, my one or two viewings of this, like, a decade ago. And, like, I couldn't believe he's gonna literally be like, you have that mark, you're that guy. And I'm just like, we're not doing it. We don't have time for this. Like, I'd love to, but we don't have time.
So back at the museum, they've basically like set everything up to resurrect Imhotep. They read from the book.
Yeah, they're going to do it there, like in London.
In London.
That was really cool, where they're like, why take this all the way back? Like, let's do this part here, get this done while we're all here.
It reminded me of, you know, like the old mummy movies where like, okay, now we have a mummy in Massachusetts. Bring the monster to civilization. I wish the movie had spent more time with Imhotep like in England, because almost immediately, like there's another couple action scenes. But once he's resurrected and he kidnaps Alex, like they're back to the Middle East and or back to North Africa.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like we could have. Just if we were slowing down, if we weren't going quite as fast, like the whole hour could have been here, chasing the mummy in London, the mummy trying to find the last piece of some artifact that he needs, and then finding out it's on Alex. Like, we could have really fleshed out. I would have liked to have seen more mummies in the streets. I like the double-decker bus idea. Like, go to Piccadilly Circus, go down to Soho. I don't know what's there in the 30s, you know, in London in the 30s, but like, I'm sure there's some cool stuff to kind of like showcase. And we definitely needed more street people being like, what's all this? And like, and like, you know, like we're there. Like, where is the what's all this then?
Yeah, I would have definitely liked to have seen more stuff in England. In the museum resurrection scene, Imhotep comes back, learns that it's the year of the scorpion, so he knows it's the right time to challenge the Scorpion King and acquire Anubis's army. He also is reunited with Anxinamen. She still doesn't have Anxinamen's soul yet. He still has to perform that same ceremony, the one he didn't get to do before. But he knows that, okay, this is the vessel. And then Anxinamen reveals that she has brought Evie to be sacrificed. Before they can do that, Rick, of course, jumps into action. This is another shootout sequence. Imhotep brings back the remaining four guards that didn't die last time. So now they're reanimated. So again, that leads to like a whole gunfight kind of scene. And then that transitions into a car chase. I'm treating this as like two separate sequences.
Okay. Well, let me go back a minute to the ceremony.
Yes.
Which I think is so cool. Again, like they're just in the basement of the museum here and doing it all. But like, I think the mummy looks cool. He's back. He's CGI. He's see-through. He's looking good. Him and Anxinamen like make out. I was like, oh, look at that. Okay. Like they kiss and it looks good. Like it looks like she's actually kissing something physical, right? Yes. Like it doesn't just look like she's kissing the air. So far, like I think they must have spent all their money on that mummy model because he's looking good and solid. He looks like he fits there. He looks like he belongs. So I really like that. I really like when he wakes up and he asks what year it is. Like, I'm just like, what? This is like the best question. Just like, how long was I out? The second question, where's Rick? No, you know, I'm going to get that asshole. Yeah, I think it's cool how they're just like on mission now. They're almost like, don't worry about those humans. They're not going to be able to stop us this time. You know, there's something bigger going on that like they don't even know. So like all that kind of stuff is fun too. So there is some interesting story elements here where it's like the bad guys have a plan. We're going to find out slowly like as they execute that plan what it is, but like the good guys have like no idea what they're going to be up to. The last movie was just all like reacting to stuff. Like no one really was like, okay, we're going to go, we're going to wake up the mummy, we're going to kill the mummy so he never comes back. It's like, no, like we're going to go and like try and find some stuff and we accidentally raise the dead. Now we got to deal with it. This is going to sort of turn into like a race almost, which is kind of fun of we got to go stop the mummy from doing what we don't know what he's going to do, but we just got to go stop him.
again, I mean, I've sort of mentioned it before, but I love the way that this cult sort of harkens back to the old evil high priests of Karnak, which Karnak is going to come up as well.
That's right. We hang out there for a while. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. So I enjoy that the cult is back to use the mummy for evil, as opposed to the Magi, who they're not really a cult.
They're like the peacekeepers. They're like a police force, like an ancient magical police force.
Right. Yeah. So then we go right into the car chase. Jonathan has found this double-decker British bus, and they're going to go barreling through the streets of London. There's some really cool stuff with Imhotep's guard mummies. They're like crawling along buildings and...
Yeah. I like that.
Amazing stuff. Amazing fighting on the bus. Ardeth Bay is like fighting half a mummy, like the top half. I love that moment when Rick is like, just like old times, huh? Rick, Evie, and Ardeth Bay, they all get chances to like fight mummies in this scene. Really cool stuff.
I like all of it. I'm trying to pinpoint, it's not exactly like any of this is bad. It's just like talking about it, it's hard to comprehend just how much is being thrown at you at once, you know? Because like we're talking about this sequence in the double-decker bus and like they're fighting all these mummies and everyone has their moments and this and that, but like it's all kind of samey in a weird way to me, you know? It's like Rick fighting the mummy isn't any different than like Jonathan fighting the mummy or Ardeth Bay fighting. Like I'm losing a little bit of like personality. They're not really telling the story the same way they did in the action of the last movie. It is much more like, okay, stop, fight, okay, start up again with the movie kind of thing going on. And, you know, and that is starting to get a little tiresome already for me watching this, you know? It's just like, I never thought I'd be saying it, but it's like, I want them to like not have an action sequence for like 25, 30 minutes and like get into some of this like backstory and like flesh out the rest of the story, please.
Yeah.
I learned very quickly to sit back, relax, and let it like wash over me for the rest of the movie.
You make a good point. I think somewhere around this point when I first started watching it, I think I had seen this one like way back when it came out, maybe on DVD. I hadn't watched it in a really long time. I really didn't remember much about it. It might have been around this time when I started to feel the same thing you did, that, okay, there's so much action in this movie. I'm kind of getting a little bit bored with it. We're not telling the story. We're just going to keep having action scenes. They are entertaining, but it's like being on a roller coaster nonstop for 2 hours. And when everything is dialed to 11, then nothing is. You get sort of sensory overload, and then like there's no more nuance anymore. And so, yeah, it was around this time that I was kind of like, okay, this thing has so much action in it. This is the movie we've signed up for. Okay. All right.
Yeah. I think that's why I appreciate what they do with Evie's visions so much, is because at least when she has a vision and she goes back in time and she has like a fight in the past, at least it's like exploring, you know, her character a little bit more, right? And like I can get behind it like that, where it's like, oh, they're actually trying to fill in some gaps here in, you know, before the last movie by doing all this. So I think that's why I give it a little more leeway, or why I like it a little more. It's not that it's better per se, but it's just that it has to do with the story a little bit more. So like I'm learning while I'm watching those fight scenes, whereas with these I feel like I'm just kind of waiting.
Yeah, by just stringing together all these action sequences, we're not really getting to the new exciting stuff in the story. So at the end of the bus chase scene, Alex is kidnapped by the cult and taken back to Egypt. And so we're going to jump all the way back over there. He's now on a train. They've got like Imhotep and Ankh-Sennamun are there. They have that chest from the first movie, the one that held the Book of the Dead. We get some exposition here. This is one of those sort of slower moments. Alex kind of learns more information about the bracelet that he's wearing. This is where he learns that he has 7 days to get to Amshir, like before he's going to die. So suddenly we have a little bit of urgency in the narrative. In that 7 days, the Scorpion King will wake up. This is where those like those three mercenaries we met, we've seen them a couple times already. They're on this train.
The mummy eats them, right?
Yes.
He just eats them here. Right? He's like, this is what you're really here for.
They're sort of trapped in a room with him. We know what's coming because we've watched that first movie. Ankh-Sennamun tells them through the door, like, he wants you to open the chest. And we know that anybody who opens the chest, their souls will be sucked out of their bodies. It's a quick way to get Imhotep back to, you know, full power. So all that happens in the span of maybe 10 minutes or so on this train.
I like the idea that they're on a train, and that's a nice set piece that we're introducing. We need I don't think we're going to fight on this train at all. I think when they meet up, they're already moved on from this. But there's a cool sequence where the kid asks to go to the bathroom and it's just like this shit covered bathroom. Yeah. It's like, why did the production team just decide now to do this gross like bathroom joke? But it does show Alex's smart thinking where he realizes he could escape through the toilet hole when the train stops. So I thought that was pretty clever little moment for him. The train happened to stop at Karnak, which was a lot of fun seeing Karnak there.
Yeah. So I actually did keep track of the path to Amshir.
Okay. So what it is they're sort of following clues. They're going from one spot to the next until they get to the oasis, right? Mm-hmm. That's the setup here. Like the bracelet will tell you like, go to the first spot and look for this. Go to the next spot and look for that. We are going to see so many quick, cool locations that we're never going to settle in. I wish this was like the middle of the movie. Like, why can't we stop at that one island place that looked amazing? And like, how did they even get to that island and move on from there? And what did they find there? This montage is going to frustrate me a little bit where it's like, we're going to quickly see them chart their path to the secret oasis.
Yeah. So far, the first stop to Amshir is the pyramids at Giza. So we go back to Giza, and then the next stop is the temple at Karnak. There's two more stops before we get to the oasis. But before we do that, Rick and company need to get some reliable transportation. This is about the midway point of the movie. Rick meets up with his old friend Izzy, who's a new character. Izzy is like an old friend of Rick's who they've gotten into. This is like the Han Solo Lando Calrissian moment. They've had this whole history. We're only going to get little pieces of it, which I thought was pretty fun, the way Izzy would bring up like all these things Rick did in his past, and Evie's like, oh, I didn't know about any of those things.
Yeah, I like this character. I don't know. I almost wish he was with them from the very beginning of the movie, you know, like as their transport guy, because he feels a little wasted. Like he's got this great intro moment with the eye patch. And he's like, oh, only way because they make me look dashing.
You're right.
And he's like, no, it doesn't. And he's got the airship. You know, I love a good steampunk airship or whatever, Final Fantasy II or whatever we're doing here. Right. And he's got the epic moment of them against like the raging water and stuff. And then he's going to disappear until the end. So I wish we had his personality to kind of like play off of. He's almost like he's a lot like Jonathan in a lot of ways, you know, like they're sort of two sides of the same coin. Maybe they're a little too similar as characters, but like,
they're both opportunists.
We don't have a lot of Jonathan in the first 10 minutes, 15 minutes either. So it would have been cool to have him. They get back from their adventure. He goes off and does his thing. You know, we switched to Jonathan and now we're coming back to him. And I enjoy him a lot.
I do enjoy how the gold scepter kind of passes back and forth from Jonathan to Izzy as Rick pays for the dirigible and then Jonathan steals it back. You know, it's a constant kind of like who's going to end up with this scepter. Other things we learn in this scene, there are 12 tribes of Magi and they're like all of the commanders show up as this like one big group with Ardeth Bay. We basically find out that like all of the 12 tribes of Magi are united to stop Imhotep and the Scorpion King and the armies that, which was pretty cool. And we meet Horus, Ardeth's hawk.
Yeah, he's got that little messenger bird of his and he sends it off every once in a while. And then one time we follow it and the shot like pans. And like you say, we see like thousands of the Magi. Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa, I didn't know there were that many.
Yeah.
And like they're all marching together, kicking up a sandstorm. I was like, I think we might win this one.
That was their Lord of the Rings moment. Like when they show of like the whole army, I was like, okay. It reminded me of when Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli, when they see the army of like orcs passing through with the elephants, just the scale of it was very Lord of the Rings. As they are on the dirigible, like heading towards, I guess, to Giza, or how do they know where they're going?
Well, okay, so every time they get to a place, they see that Alex left a little sandcastle clue, right? There was that one time at Karnak where he asked for like some water and he just kind of pours it on the ground and you're like, what the fuck?
Right.
Like, doesn't he want to drink that? And then like Rick shows up and he's like, look, he made a diagram in the sand. He drew a castle. And it's like this perfectly made model of like where to go next. So it's whatever he sees, he lets them know. So the temple tracking.
I think they know that they have to at least get to Karnak. I think when they meet Izzy, their first stop is Karnak. So that's where they're headed. There's some really cool special effects, digital effects as they're flying through the air. One important detail that I made note of, like this is where we discover, like at the center of this oasis is a gold pyramid from which no one has ever returned.
Let's just add more stuff to this because like, why not? Sure. On top of everything else, there's a gold pyramid at the center of the oasis. All right.
And everybody who has ever sought it out has never come back.
So we know it's there for a fact because everyone who went looking for it died. Like, right. What? That's my favorite. It's like, how do you even know it's really there? Because no one's ever come back.
My favorite thing is that I think multiple times throughout this movie, Ardith says the phrase, it is written. But Jonathan at one point is like, where is all this written? He is me in that moment, like wondering as the audience, where the fuck is all this shit written?
Well, Dan, there's at least two books. One is solid gold and one is black as death. And there's got, maybe that's written somewhere in those two books at some point. Maybe there's a third book bound in human flesh.
I promise I'm not nitpicking. I still enjoy this movie. If there's a question to ask, I need to ask it. And that's it.
No, you know what would have been helpful too is like we're going to go back to the past and see, you know, the mummy before he's the mummy, Aksunama and Evie before she was Evie and all this. Like, show us Ardith Bey back then. Like, right. Show us his ancestor and show us some of the shit he was getting up to. Maybe he was the guy writing all of this down somewhere.
Right.
That would have been the perfect thing is to like cut to, oh, we have to go consult the oracle or whatever. And you go into the temple and there's one guy in there with scrolls surrounding him and everything. And he turns around and it's the guy who plays Ardith Bey. And it's like, there's your connection. He wrote it all down. They've been saving it this whole time. Oh, also, okay, I got one thing about this airship. They go way too high in this airship. Yeah. Like they're flying above the clouds. They're in space at one point in this airship. Like they should be frozen to death or suffocating. That's all I got to say about the airship. Otherwise, I love an airship.
So just after that whole sequence, the train stops at Karnak. That scene you describe, Alex asks to use the bathroom. He stops the train.
It looks so awesome, too. I don't know what it is about that place in reality that I'm so drawn to. So, like, it was really cool to see, like, oh, we're actually here. I mean, I only know because of Watchmen. Like, Ozymandias was obsessed with Ramses II, and he basically brought all of Karnak to the North Pole or some shit was, like, in Watchmen. So that's the first time I was like, oh, is this real? And like, I was looking up stuff about it.
Right on. I assumed that it was just a reference to the original Mummy series, but I suppose they were drawing from reality as well, just like, you know, a lot of the other stuff that they drew from King Tut and other things. Okay, so this is where Evie has her flashback. It's sort of Evie's flashback, but also Imhotep is showing Anxinamen her past.
Yeah, I wondered, see, they could have done a simple thing where that was connected. From the mummy showing her the past, it triggers Evie at the same time somehow, and everybody's looking at the same time.
Well, that's how I read that scene.
All right, I figured that's what was going on, but I thought that she was sort of like drifting on her own, and it was like a coincidence that they were doing this at the same time.
I mean, it's not clearly stated, but that's how I interpreted the scene, that, you know, Imhotep was showing her this vision, and then Evie was sort of like intercepting the signal, you know, so to speak. And then,
oh, okay, that works.
Yeah. There's some cool stuff here that harkens back to the old mummy stuff. We, of course, get a fight sequence between Anxinamen and Nefertiti, who is played by Rachel Weisz as well.
Yeah, and she is the Pharaoh's daughter.
Correct. As a result of the fight, Anxinamen wins the fight and is named the protector of the Pharaoh as well as his future wife.
Yeah, and Evie becomes protector of the scorpion bracelet.
Correct.
Second prize.
Just like one of the old mummy films, we get some repurposed footage from the original mummy.
Yeah.
Or from the previous Stephen Sommers mummy, I should say. It's the whole sequence with Anxinamen and Imhotep and their infidelity. It's that whole scene from the beginning of the first mummy movie, except this time Nefertiti is watching from her window.
We find out that she sounded the alarm, actually. She's the one that's like, guards, get up there.
She saw her father die, and she alerted the Magi, who, you know, stormed in, and we know the rest. So I kind of enjoyed the way she was worked into this old scene, just to tie her into the continuity.
See, they can do it, man. Like, that was nice and clean. I had no problem with the way that they integrate her into the past, and it's not hard at all to understand, you know? It feels very seamless. It's like, I wish they were they're doing that a little more in other parts of this movie, where it's like, it just takes this little scene to kind of lock it all together. If we just had one scene of Rick as a kid, you know, like surrounded by people and him like not like kind of remembering, like that's all. We just needed one thing.
I feel like they could have cut Alex as a character out of this movie and then spent that extra time on Rick's history as a young Magi.
Definitely. I mean, I like Alex is fine, but like you could definitely move all that stuff to some. I mean, just give it to Evie while she's, you know, like what better thing to trigger her past life than the bracelet she was sought to protect attached to her wrist, you know, like that gets on her and like, boom, like it's like a flash of lightning, like all of those memories come back, or they come back throughout the course of the movie, but it's very much tied to her character. It would have been very seamless to just put all that stuff to her.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I'm not going to say that I dislike Alex's inclusion on principle because, you know, he's a kid. And
no, that's not it for me at all. You know, no, I feel that could work. I feel like there are other ways to work Alex in here that are better, that would have been cooler. I just think like he's a little too young maybe to be on this adventure with us this time. He seems kind of out of place.
It just feels like they introduced too many new things for Rick and Evie that took a backseat to Alex being in the movie. After this vision sequence, Imhotep completes the ceremony that restores Anxinamen's soul to her body. And now they are officially back completely.
They're shipping again, right? Yeah. That's what the kids say.
So now we're back in the present, and this is about when Alex starts leaving clues. When they're at Karnak, he leaves the clue letting his parents know they are headed for the Temple Island Falai.
Oh, man, that shot is so cool. And then they go to another temple that's like half buried in the side of a mountain. It looks like Indiana Jones 3.
Yeah, that's the Temple of Abu Simbel, I believe.
This temple hopping montage is so cool looking. I just wish we were going into these temples, especially that island one. Like, just make that the one temple of the movie. Make that, you know, the one place. It looks so cool. There's so much to do there. The imagination at least there's that, right? Like, at least Stephen Sommers knows how to like stoke your mind to be like, oh, I wonder what's in there. Like, what would be going on there? Even if we're not spending time there, like I'm starting to make up like what kind of creature lives there.
These look like really cool places, but for the purposes of the story, they're really just rest stops, which is a little bit unfortunate.
They're totally rest stops. It might as well be like the Bon Jovi rest stop, like on the parkway, because like that's all it is.
Eventually, the heroes do catch up with Imhotep and Anxinamen and Alex. And this is, okay, so this is our seventh action sequence for those keeping a tally at home. This is the canyon sequence with the wall of water.
Okay.
It's basically a recycled sandstorm sequence from the first Mummy. Now it's water and they're in an airship and not a biplane.
Yeah, it's basically kind of the same exact thing except water.
So there are certain moments in this movie that where they're like sort of calling back to the first one. This is one of those moments where I thought, okay, this is a big sequence. It's a big special effect. This isn't subtle. I don't love that they just took the sand and turned it into water and gave it the face and did the exact same thing.
Like, you got to take it an extra step, right? Like, he's got to be more than a face. He's got to be like a whole body. Like, you got to do like kaiju mummy made of water stalking them through the canyon. You just need to do something else because it's the only time that kind of felt not a callback, but like a retread. You know what I mean? Right? Like there's a difference. And it just kind of felt like you're right. Like we'd take the same shot and just slap a new coat of paint on it. And I was like, it's not doing it for me anymore. I don't know. The physics definitely look different between sand and water and the water physics of this. I mean, I'm not that sophisticated when it comes to special effects, but I watch a lot of them. And like until nowadays, water physics are way more advanced than this kind of stuff. But even for back then, I was like, it just looks like they kind of took the last shot and changed it from yellow to blue. Conceptually, it needed a lot of work. Unfortunately, it didn't do what I think they were expecting it to do, which was be like, remember how cool this was in the last movie? Well, look how much cooler it is because we're doing it again. I was like, no, I think it was the last movie was just all around awesome and anything that happened was going to kick ass. And like here, you're just reminding me of like, we got too much going on in this one. Like this belongs in the last movie. Like do something new for this movie.
Yeah, I mean, they've got Imhotep back to full power, and I mean, he's got some pretty impressive abilities. He's basically just digging back into the same bag of tricks. In fact, for being at full strength, it seems like he utilizes fewer of his abilities in this one than he did in the first one. Like in the first one, he was like turning into sandstorms, coming through keyholes and doors.
He was like spitting out insects and taking people, like possessing people and all kinds of plagues.
And all he's got here is a wall of water that is the same thing as the sand effect from before. Like, that's it. It is a fun sequence. I guess if this was your first experience with a modern Mummy movie, yeah, it's cool. But for those of us who love that first one, this is just more of the same. I'm not completely averse to this wall of water and the face. It's just like, if you're going to have him do that, do something different with it.
Yeah, and you have Aksunama now, like the two of you holding hands. Maybe there's two water faces, you know, like they just needed an extra kick. It just didn't feel like they were kicking it up a notch the way they might have expected.
Yeah. So it ends with the water destroying the dirigible, but they've reached the end of the canyon, and just off in the horizon is Amshir.
The magical oasis.
The jungle oasis.
Which is, I like this, again, I will concede there are a lot of really cool, too many cool ideas. But like, I think all the ideas are still cool. Even though I'm like dissing some of it, it's just because there's too much of it. But it's like each individual idea I feel like has merit and is cool enough to work somehow. But I really love the concept of this oasis. Maybe just because the idea of an oasis in a desert has always been very alluring. That has always been in the back of my mind as something in the desert that was like very cool and sort of maybe magical at some point. So like, I do dig the fact that basically at the end, we're in Skull Island for the next hour. Like, right. That's kind of how it feels to me, right? We're like, we get to this oasis in the desert where it's a jungle, and now we can have jungle monsters and things and more like King Kong type of adventures where we're like swinging on vines or jumping across big canyons and ditches.
Like, it doesn't feel shoehorned in, like the change of scenery. Stephen Sommers found a way, an organic way, to have a jungle adventure in a desert. Like, so we get desert stuff, and then we get like almost 40 minutes of jungle adventure. That's cool.
And Rick fits perfectly here, because we talk about how he's kind of this Indiana Jones type character, and like that guy shows up in jungle all the time. And so it's great to get Rick in a new environment as well, like that.
Absolutely. So they start heading towards the pyramid. Izzy is kind of left behind. We won't see him again until the very end.
Yeah, he's got to blow up the balloon, remember?
Yeah, well, his problem is that originally the balloon was filled with a gas. Now he has to find a way to reassemble this and reinflate it with hot air. So now as they're making their way through the jungle, there's a short sequence where Ardith gives Horus a message and sends him on his way, and then Lachna shoots him out of the sky. R.I.P. Horus.
Real quick about Horus, you notice he gets killed off screen, which I appreciated. Yep. As much as he's pushing this movie, he's really pulling back, because I think he realized we got a lot more kids in the audience. And I think that's a reason Alex is here too. And I think it's a reason we're going to get like mini mummies in a couple minutes as well. It's going to start getting a little sillier.
I definitely felt that as well. This was made with kids in mind as opposed to the original. So as the cult all make their way through the jungle, they find remains of Roman legionnaires and some of Napoleon's troops. Like over the course of history, like all these great world leaders had sent their men out looking for this oasis.
I wonder if this is in the new Napoleon movie.
We know that in like 5 years' time, you know, Hitler's sending Nazis out into the desert looking for Amshir. It tracks that there would be this all-powerful like artifact that military leaders would seek out.
Yeah, that's a great detail that makes it feel almost like Bermuda Triangle. That's a cool little touch.
Lots of shrunken heads too, which it's a little bit broad for an adventure movie, but also felt right for a 1930s set serial adventure. A little cartoony, but I think it works here. Rick and company do catch up to the cult, and they have one goal in mind: to rescue Alex, but they got to do it tactfully. And the plan is for Rick and Ardith to head into the jungle to ambush the cult while Evie and Jonathan provide cover from up high, up on a cliff face. And then this begins the next big action sequence. The cult trigger these like pygmy mummies. And it just becomes complete bedlam as Rick and Ardith are killing cultists and pygmy mummies all to save Alex. So there's a lot going on in this sequence.
The tone of this is really interesting. I feel like it just rides it right in a way that a lot of other movies around the time like kind of didn't really work it right. Like I think of like the prequels and I think of Lord of the Rings when I'm watching this sequence and I'm like, they didn't really pull off being able to make jokes like this in the middle of their action. Like, oh, there'd be like a big Jedi sequence and then C-3PO would be like, oh, my head, I've lost my head and stuff. And you'd be like, oh no, like now we gotta find his head. Just the idea of like you're in the middle of some serious action and then like this very sort of childlike thing will happen and kind of throw it off a little bit. I feel like that's happening here, but it's not throwing it off. In a weird way, maybe it's because of the barrage and like the nature of this movie is just like constantly going and never stopping. Like there's this ADD to it that when we get here and it really kind of flies off the rails, like it's working more for me. Like, oh, you know, like I'm almost like if this was all a cartoon, would it be better? You know, if they went even further and like had to use more CGI to explain and incorporate things. Then when we get to the rock at the end, I eat my words, of course. I'm like, no, we've flown too close to the sun for sure. And that's the reason, like, you don't realize it until you're there. And the flight is beautiful until you get there and then you crash and burn. But at the moment, I was definitely not expecting to go along with like these mini mummy monster things. Another part of me would have just been like, this is so patently ridiculous. I can't get into it. But I'm at a point where I'm like, no, just like keep throwing shit at me because whatever it is, it's just going to be fun at this point. Like, I'm not taking this movie seriously. I do not hold it in as high regard as the last movie, but I still like it. For what it is, I'm still with it.
Yeah. So I actually want to read you a quote. I was saving this for this part of the episode. Steven Summers, I don't know where he said this, but in one of the extras on the disc, somebody quoted him as saying, "The pygmies alone will be worth the price of admission." He was banking on these.
He's like, the movie doesn't even start until they show up. That makes a lot of sense now. I really feel like they restrained him in the last movie then. Like, that was probably supposed to be this. And then they were just like, all right, do what you want, do what you're going to do. And this is him just like unrestrained, just like every idea that I have, I need to get in. And kudos to him for fitting it in. We're going to see again in Van Helsing. He's got a lot of ideas.
Yes.
And somehow he manages to fit them all in there for better or worse.
I wanted to address some of the stuff you were saying about the scene. Like, it does feel cartoony to me to a degree. There were moments in it where it reminded me of scenes in Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, where so many of those sequences felt tonally inconsistent with everything else I love about Indiana Jones. I think I came out of Crystal Skull, like both times that I saw it, thinking this would have been better as an animated movie or an animated adventure. We know that the Mummy franchise also became an animated show. I think it lasted, what did we say, 2 seasons? The Pygmies would be right at home on that animated series. But here, considering the goal of this sequence, which is a rescue operation to save Rick and Evie's son from a cult that wants to kill him, the Pygmies kind of undermine the seriousness of that for me. I don't know that I enjoy it as much as you seem to. It's just, it's too much happening in one scene for me, you know, because we've got all these like sword fights. We've got a great sword fight between Lachna and Ardeth Bay, which, you know, he's getting his vengeance for Horus. We're rescuing Alex. And there's enough peril there that we don't really need the Pygmies, but we have them on top of everything else. And it feels chaotic, kind of in a bad way. Taken individually, I think that the Pygmies have some really fun gags, some really cool moments throughout this sequence. But as a whole, I struggle to really enjoy the sequence. I think it's a little bit too convoluted and it wants me to have fun, but also be caught up in the tension of rescuing Alex. And I don't think it can have both at the same time.
I don't think it does. Like, I'm with you, right? Mostly for like everything you said, except for the fact that like, that's why I think I enjoy it is because it's at a point in the movie where Summers just like can't help himself.
Right.
You know, it's like, we've got enough. And there is that tension. And like the last thing we need are like these little cartoon things chasing us, but here they are. So it's like trying to make sense of all this and doing like my mental gymnastics. I'm kind of at the point in the movie where I'm like, why not? But I totally understand, like, it's not helping. It is not helping at all. Okay. But we're here. I've sort of resigned myself for the end of this movie to be like, just show me what else you're going to do. Just like, what else could possibly go on? We still haven't gotten the army of Anubis monsters yet again, you know, like that whole thing is going to get even crazier than the opening sequence. I just get this sense that he's ramping up to the end, you know? So like, if he's going to do that, I'm going to try and match him.
In hindsight, he's like, okay, this is like the precursor to the finale. This is getting me primed for three action sequences all at the same time. In that light, it definitely makes sense. Like, that was what was going through his mind, is that like he needed to ramp up the energy and really get us ready for the 20 to 30 minutes of nonstop action we're going to get.
Yeah, it is going to be a endurance test once we get there.
Rick is successful. They get Alex and they escape from the cult. Yeah, so everything pretty much goes as well as it can for them. And this is where Alex finally breaks the news to his parents that if we don't get to the pyramid today before the sun comes up, I'm gonna die. And so Rick just sprints through the jungle with Alex in his arms, outruns the sun, and dives into the pyramid at the last possible second.
So that's what we needed to build to. He needed to try and be able to pull off this shot of Rick literally outrunning the sunrise. I truly believe that's what everything about that last sequence was about, was to like just try and get a rise out of these people, because the next shot they're really not going to be with you for that shot of Rick racing the sun, because even I'm like, no, I can't buy that. Like, that is just a little too ridiculous. Just looking at it, just like visually, like, we know it doesn't work that way. I'm willing to suspend disbelief and create new rules for pygmy mummies and all kinds of dog creatures that are going to be running at me, but like that, I might have to draw the line.
I just remembered how many times I described certain bits of the previous Mummy as like just Looney Tunes shit. And I take it all back. This movie is like legit straight up Looney Tunes, like the whole thing, especially Rick outrunning the sun. But it's movie logic, so we go along with it because we have to. Alex is saved. He's not going to die. The bracelet pops off his wrist. And as we are taking a breath, Evie is suddenly killed by Ankh Senaman outside the pyramid. I don't know about you. This is a huge moment.
Huge.
I didn't feel the emotional pull of this scene that they needed me to feel because of how busy everything is before it.
And it's not necessary. Like, I was shocked they did it because they're just going to bring her back in 5 minutes.
Right.
You know, so like, what's the point of just going through those motions? Why not just have her here and either think of something else or skip it?
Yeah.
Just like move past it and like, let's just get onto the other side of it already and all that. I mean, the only thing it really does is create a murderous rage inside of Rick for about 15 minutes, which gives him like the superhuman strength to just destroy everything in sight and take on the mummy one-on-one, you know, fight him into the gates of hell and all that kind of shit. That doesn't even last, because as soon as the Scorpion King shows up, like, they almost have to team up against him at some point. And then he sees that Evie's alive again anyway. Yeah, this was a real strange turn. It almost feels like leftover from a certain draft, or, you know, a page that got stuck at the end that was supposed to be in the middle. You know, if she had died halfway through the movie and came back at the end, that would have been a whole different story.
Sure.
If that's what was supposed to be happening. But yeah, it felt very sudden and very unnecessary.
Okay, so you've sort of set the stage. Like, let's go through the beats. We're heading towards the grand finale here.
Real quickly, the mummy's plan at this point, wake up the Scorpion King and just kill him?
Yes.
Okay.
Imhotep's whole thing is he's banging that gong to wake up the Scorpion King. He's going to just kill him. But I don't think he knows that he needs that spear yet.
No. No one knows they need the spear destiny.
Until later. We'll get to that.
Yeah. And I don't think they're expecting him to be a crab monster. Right? Like, right. I don't think they're expecting the door to open and see this like monstrosity emerge of like nightmare fuel.
So he walks in, suddenly he can't use his powers anymore, and he believes that Anubis wants him to defeat the Scorpion King as a mortal.
Didn't he like cross a threshold though, and like the ground cracks open? Yeah, and we see like to hell and all those bodies and stuff.
Yeah. And he's banging the big gong to call the Scorpion King. Hafez, the museum curator, who I should say has been present throughout this movie, has done some really funny stuff. Like back during the pygmy sequence, he like tells these two cultists, sacrifice yourself for me. And he runs away into the jungle. But here he finds the bracelet of Anubis, puts it on, and then sticks his arm into this shrine to release the Anubis army.
Oh, right. Yeah.
As a result of that, he like loses the hand. He pulls out a skeleton hand, which is super fun. Really loved that effect.
And the Anubis dog boys, they form in like the front lines right outside of the oasis where all the Magi are posted up waiting.
Yes, the Magi have assembled, and their role in this whole thing is to keep Anubis's army at bay. So Imhotep, without his power, is still headstrong about fighting the Scorpion King, believing if he were to die that the Book of the Dead will be able to resurrect him.
Yeah, we know that it is able to do that on multiple occasions because we just saw it resurrect Evie.
Yes.
There's a cute moment. I like when Jonathan and Alex are working together to decode like the resurrection spell.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like this great uncle nephew moment where he's like, what's the one that's kind of got the arm like this and doing the thing? Uh-huh. And he knows and he's like, oh, right, blimey. And they like solved it together. I was like, as an uncle, yeah. I was like, I appreciated that moment.
Hell yeah. Jonathan picks a fight with Ankh Senaman to buy some time before they do that, because they still need to find the Book of the Dead, and Alex needs to find the passage to bring Evie back. So Jonathan stalls by picking a fight with Ankh Senaman, gets his ass kicked.
There's always that great moment where he like slaps her and he realizes he just hit a woman.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh shit. And she's like, that didn't hurt at all. I'm going to just kick your ass now.
Rick arrives as Imhotep is summoning the Scorpion King. I'm going to break this down as much as best I can, and then we can sort of discuss the details that we like or whatever. So at the same time, we're going to get Rick fighting Imhotep. The Magi army is fighting the Anubis army, and Jonathan is fighting Ankh Senaman.
Right.
So that's all happening at the same time. Eventually, Alex reads the correct passage from the Book of the Dead. Evie is resurrected, and then she steps in for Jonathan, and then they have their sort of rematch.
She like tags in.
Yeah. And then as that's happening, the Scorpion King bursts through the door. Rick and Imhotep sort of stop fighting each other. Imhotep kind of dimes Rick out, says, no, yeah, I'm your servant. He's the one who came here to kill you.
What a little bitch. He's like, because he's like, I'm going to go in there and kick this Scorpion King's ass. And they're like, yeah. And he gets in there and he's like, he's the guy. Kill that guy, not me. That is not what I want my mummy to do, you know? In that moment, I was so disenfranchised. I was like, wait, what? Like, you're supposed to stand up to this thing.
Yeah. Strange moment for Imhotep, for sure. Let's see. Okay, so then Rick has to fight the Scorpion King. He's doing the best he can. He's kicking ass. We get some more of Evie versus Ankh Senaman before Hafez comes running into the room with his skeleton arm. The Scorpion King, like, rips him into pieces. I love that moment when he's, like, asking Imhotep for help, and he's like, why?
I like when the Scorpion King rips the dude into pieces, and, like, Rick and Imhotep kind of look at each other like, uh-oh, he's way bigger and stronger than I think we realized.
It's about at that point that Rick sees the hieroglyphics on the wall that show...
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, it's a series of images of a figure with the tattoo on the wrist, just like Rick's. And he's like impaling the Scorpion King with this golden spear of Osiris. It's the spear of Osiris. And suddenly Rick puts it together. Like, that golden scepter they've been carrying around is actually a spear.
Not only that, he also put together the fact that he's the guy in the hieroglyphics.
Yes.
Right? Like, how crazy is that? He basically like looks over on the wall and there's instructions on how to kill the Scorpion King, and it's him.
Yes.
He's like, yeah, that thing is a spear. It's like, that's the tattoo. So that guy is you. There's the scorpion. So that's the king guy. Like, yeah, just stab him with the spear of destiny and you win. I couldn't believe the coincidence. It's like the directions are right there on the wall on how to kill the guy in his own temple.
Yes, it's the most convenient thing in the world. So yeah, Rick is now a believer. There's a whole to do with the spear.
Oh, yeah, like unwinding it or like extending it correctly.
Yeah. Jonathan throws the spear at the Scorpion King. Imhotep intercepts it. Then Imhotep throws the spear, and then Rick intercepts it. And then as he is sort of about to get thrown into that pit to hell, he impales the Scorpion King with the spear. And while that's happening, we've almost forgot that the Magi are outside fighting the Anubis army, and they defeat the first wave of this army, and then a second one, a huge army, is coming over the hills. And as Rick impales the Scorpion King, and as this army like just reaches the Magi, they turn into like a black dust.
There's some cool stuff with that Anubis army fight, actually. Like, I'm still pretty impressed with the look of the Jackal Man. Like, yes. That's pretty cool. I definitely, like, grew on me. I like how Art of the Bay's, like, you know, go for the head, you know, just cut off the head, and they turn to, like, this dust, the sand and everything. And they make pretty quick work of the first wave. And I was like, oh, man, it's Anubis army or a bunch of punks. And then suddenly, like, there's just twice as many. And the look on their face is like, no, like, yeah, we're done. And I don't think I've seen that in a movie portrayed that well, especially in a movie like this. It's like the look on all their face is just such defeat, and like they've given up and they're not gonna fight, and like they basically laid down their swords and are waiting to get rushed by this next wave of the army when Rick saves the day and they all like kind of vanish.
Well, I mean, they were gonna put up a fight to the very end. Like, Ardith like yells, like, you know, to death, and they all raise their swords and they're gonna fight to the last man, right? Like,
that's, yeah, but there's definitely the realization that, like,
yes,
like right after being like, we did it, being like, no, like, we're not gonna make this, like, we're still gonna do this, but we're not coming back. I didn't expect that to be written all over their faces in the way that it was in a movie like this, you know, like, you really get the sense of like, they're done. So I mean, maybe that's good directing, at least on that end, you know. Maybe it was just exhaustion on the faces of the actors or something, but like, I don't know. I felt that all these things going on at the same time are not a problem. Like, he's doing a really good job delegating time to each of these properly and cutting back and forth really well.
Yes. You know,
the only thing I really have an issue with in this climax is the way that the Scorpion King kind of got rendered. It's become kind of a study in special effects over the years. I know there's a bunch of YouTube channels devoted like just to this sequence and like trying to like fix it and things with like deep fakes and stuff. It's on screen for such a small amount of time. I'm of the mind now where conceptually I thought it was a cool idea, so I don't really care about the execution. You're never going to be able to execute this really perfectly anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I like the concept of the Scorpion King, so therefore I'm going to allow the jankiness of the Scorpion King.
To call it out for being unimpressive, it's been done. I'm not here to rag on it. It is what it is. I think I heard somewhere in an interview with Brendan Fraser as he was talking about making it, and possibly that they were just in a hurry. I think I mentioned this earlier before. They were in a hurry to get this thing out, and they just didn't have the time to finish. I'm with you in that the concept is really cool. I love that. I mean, it's not really explained. We've sort of already addressed that, but I kind of love that the Scorpion King has morphed into this like bug monster.
Yeah, we got a couple movies to find out how that happened.
Yes.
He better turn into this thing at the end of part 4 or 5.
I'm with you. At this point, it's so long after the fact that to continue to harp on the bad effects, it's not worth it anymore. I do think it's cool conceptually, and it is a well-executed sequence. I do agree with you that it's all cut well together. I don't get confused or lost at all throughout all of this stuff. I know exactly where everybody is and what's happening. Really incredible job by the editor here. So as the Scorpion King is dead, the entire temple begins to fall apart. We've got these, like, the ceiling is sort of caving in on everything.
There's a great moment when Imhotep is looking at Aksunama to, like, help him out. And she, like, takes one look at the whole scene and, like, runs away.
Yeah.
And there's this look on his face of, like, you traitor. That's the one moment where I really felt for the mummy, where I was like, oh, man, you're just like the rest of us. Like, she just dogged you.
It might be Arnold Vosloo's single greatest performance in both movies. The way his entire demeanor changes in that moment as the woman, yeah, that he has crossed oceans of time, you know, he's been resurrected multiple times, to bring her back so that they can live together forever, has just left him. has abandoned him in his moment of need. That expression on his face, it's my favorite thing Arnold Vosloo has done as the mummy across this whole franchise.
Yeah, it's incredible. And it totally justifies why he just kind of does a swan dive into like the gates of hell. He's just like, screw it. He's like, it's over. He's like, I'd rather toil as in an eternity in hell than have to be back up here.
And meanwhile, Evie runs through everything to, you know, she risks life and limb to save Rick mm-hmm. from falling into that hole. So the two of them manage to escape with Jonathan and Alex. And let's not forget that as soon as Ankh-Sennamun abandons Imhotep, she like runs out of the room and falls into a pit of scarabs and is eaten alive. So she does receive her just desserts.
By becoming their dessert.
That's right. Really great effect of like, you just see the arm sticking out with her eye visible, and then it all just sort of gets enveloped in scarabs. So
I really like the imploding temple stuff too.
Yep.
Like, I think this is a really cool concept. It takes the last movie to like the next degree, where instead of just the sand filling everything in, it's actually getting, everything is getting sucked into it like some kind of black hole or like some kind of vortex or something, and they got to get the heck out of there.
Yes, it's a really incredible sequence. It's sort of like the opposite of how Amshir arrives in the beginning, in the opening prologue. It sort of just explodes out of nothing and create, and it's this oasis, right? And now it's the reverse. Everything's getting sucked into the pyramid. The heroes have to climb up the pyramid as this is all happening. At the very last second, Izzy is there to rescue them. So they have that moment. They all jump from the pyramid to like a rope ladder to get up onto the dirigible. I love that Jonathan is still fixated on this like last piece of treasure at the top of the mm-hmm. pyramid. He does manage to get it. As everything is sort of sucked into the sand, like a big cloud of smoke and sand, you know, erupts out of this hole in the ground. And then you see the little dirigible fly out of it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, they fly off into the sunset, into safety.
And Ardeth Bay bids them a farewell. And that's the end of the movie. They literally just fly off into the sunset onto their next adventure. We sort of breeze through the climactic fight. Is there anything that we left out?
I don't think so. I mean, that's the thing about this one is like, you know, we were saying in the last movie, there's so many of these like moments within the fights to pull out and dissect and talk about and like change while they're fighting. This one, not so much. It's just like fight action and things, and that's fine too. During the final fight with the Scorpion King, when Rick stabs him with the Spear of Destiny, I always thought it was kind of an awkward framing, the shot where like the mummy just like jumps into frame and he's like, no. And then, like, I always thought that was kind of accidentally comical, the way that it was staged and everything. I still felt that way. I thought that was a little like, I was laughing a little bit too much there towards the end, where I was supposed to maybe be a little more thrilled at that point, but that was the only thing that kind of stuck out at me as like a moment within a moment that I wanted to mention. But otherwise, like, since we end where we are, I don't really have a problem with anything once we're there. You know, my feelings about the movie is just like getting there was like a lot of convoluted stuff and a lot of padding and a lot of extra, or just like a lot of stuff that could have been saved for another movie, and there's plenty to mine for this one. Like, we just introduced enough stuff to focus on this story. It seems like there's a lot of other things going on in the peripheral of this movie that I don't really have a solid grip on. But overall, I still had a hell of an adventure. Like, this is still a lot of fun, and there's a lot of forgettable action adventure stuff out there, and this is still memorable to me. You know, beyond it just being the Mummy series, like, I still feel like it's got a lot of really cool ideas. I like the actors. I like a lot of that's still happening. So you might have heard a lot of sort of frustration or complaining or things like that during the course of this episode, but I mean, I think it's just because I cared enough to want it to be the best it is, yes, or the best it could be. You know, you can feel the sensibilities are just a little different this time around, right? I mean, this feels way more okay. Stephen Sommers is getting a chance to do everything he wants the way he wants, whereas I feel last time there's a lot of him in that movie, but there's also a lot of studio saying like, cool your jets, like, not so much, maybe next time, like, just focus. And this definitely lacks focus, but for a movie that lacks focus from 2001, it could be a hell of a lot worse. Like, it could have a personality disorder that I don't think it does have, that some movies do. So all in all, I still had a really fun time. You know, might be a step down, but like, how couldn't it be? Like, the last movie was so great. Mm-hmm. And I'm still thinking about that movie while I'm watching this movie. So maybe that's the thing. Maybe it was just a little too soon. Maybe it's just a little too derivative because of the distance between the last movie. But ultimately, in the end, I mean, I'm still here talking about it, having a good time talking about it.
I agree with everything you just said. That's pretty much how I feel about it, too. It is really fun. It is much more of a ride than the first Mummy was. And that's cool. Like, I think taken individually, a lot of these sequences are really fun. I think it really just becomes a bit much when you string everything together the way Stephen Sommers has here. But at the end of the day, we're still watching these characters we like doing things that are fun and exciting. You know, maybe we were a little bit negative or a little bit hard on this one. I find that I am a little more hard on the movies that I like. In this case, I feel like it could have been better if they had done these other things or if they hadn't done certain things. It's a movie I like enough to expend as much energy on as I have. If I didn't like this movie at all, you know, this would have been a very short episode probably.
Well, also, I think our attitudes would be way worse about it as well, right?
Sure. Yeah. I came into this movie wanting to like as much as possible, and I do like a lot of it. Maybe it's like you said, that we had just watched the first Mummy, which is so amazing and so perfect, and we're immediately following it up with this. And so naturally, we're going to compare the two. You know, I still think a lot of the criticisms are valid, but maybe things feel worse in the moment now because the first Mummy is so fresh in our mind. It's hard to say. Mm-hmm. I would like to revisit this one in a couple years and see if I still feel the same way. It's still a fun movie. And if you like that first Mummy movie, there's going to be a lot of stuff in this movie that you like too. With that, you know, it's almost time for us to sail off into our own sunset, but we will be back on Friday, January 26th, heading back to the desert for our third consecutive episode to discuss The Scorpion King. Now, Mike, you've already sort of revealed our hand a little bit, I think, but I think this is a good time to announce that we are going to include the whole Scorpion King franchise this season.
We gotta do it. I think so. There's two reasons. One, we kind of want more movies.
Sure.
Right? Like, there's more movies we want to watch during this run, if you will. And then also, it's part of the series. It's part of the franchise, right? So like, we went, when we did the original Mummies and stuff, like, we didn't skimp on any of those, right? So if Universal put it out, we watched it. And technically, there's a couple Scorpion King direct to video sequels that are canon, for lack of a better term, that we're going to watch.
The way I see it is, you know, this is a universe that was built on the Universal monsters, specifically
yes.
The Mummy. And now this is the studio in a more modern era, taking that idea and doing something different with it. I feel like we would be remiss if we didn't explore what Universal had to offer with this new direction. You know, whether it's successful or not, we're going to find out. But I think it's important to acknowledge that this is what Universal wanted to do with the Mummy franchise.
Yeah.
And spin it off into something else. It may be lacking monsters. That's going to be my prediction. I haven't seen any of the Scorpion King movies.
Me neither.
I suspect that it will be more sword and sandal adventure than monster movies.
All right. Well, if we get even a tenth of Conan the Barbarian in one of these movies, I'll be happy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it might be controversial for our listeners, you know, because we're going to be going off down that road and including those movies with everything else. For those of you listening who are not excited to talk about Scorpion King or hear us talk about Scorpion King, I do have good news for you. The way that it works out chronologically, you're going to get a Scorpion King movie like on either side of things like Van Helsing and Dracula. And, you know, so you're not going to have to just listen to Scorpion King episodes like 2-3 months in a row.
Oh, good. And we don't have to watch like 4 Scorpion King movies in a row.
Right. Yeah. I just think for posterity, we should see the Scorpion King through to the end alongside everything else. Because it's, I mean, these things evolve over time. And that's sort of the reason why we do this podcast, to see how the Universal monsters and their universes have evolved over time. That's the announcement for this episode. So look for us again, January 26th for the Scorpion King. Before we go, we do have some monster mail to get to.
Oh, excellent.
We have one email from Vincent Priceless.
Excellent.
Yes. He says, "Hey guys, I'm happy to see new episodes. I really enjoyed your series on the classic Universal movies. You have a nice, easy chemistry, and I like the deep dives on production history. As long as you cover horror movies, I'll be listening. At the risk of stating the obvious, have you considered covering the RKO horror films? All the best, the Streaming Skull."
Excellent. Love the pseudonyms.
Yes. We get two. So one thing at a time here. Definitely appreciate the compliments, and I love that you're listening. We're happy to have you as a listener. Every time someone tells us that they enjoy what we do, it just gives me more motivation to keep going. So let's see, RKO horror films.
Yeah.
The show was conceived as a Universal Monster podcast. And over the years that we've been doing this show, it's become clear, at least to me, that Mike and I have plenty of things that we could say about horror outside of that umbrella, right? Or outside of that sphere. So I don't know if it'll be part of this show. I would definitely love to explore the idea of doing like RKO or other horror movies under some other banner. I'm not going to discount it. I would just say that probably for this specific show, probably not. But I would love to talk about RKO horror.
Yeah. I think our desire, like our dream would be to eventually cover everything. We will work through Universal, then we'll go back, we'll do like all the other kind of monsters, you know, like King Kong or The Fly and, you know, all the people that aren't associated with this main core Universal group, and then also explore into other horror. And, you know, it all depends on how long we last and what comes down the pike. But yeah, there's definitely a chance that we will cover that someday in the future, somehow. Some way.
Yeah, it's definitely something that I have an interest in doing. As long as we have the time and the ability to do so. My schedule is pretty full up at the moment, so I wouldn't hold my breath for it, but it's possible at some point for sure.
Yeah, slow and steady with this podcast, you know?
That's right.
That's that we're going to win this race.
Okay, so that's the end of our Monster Mail. You can follow us on X, aka Twitter, at Monster Made Pod. We're also on Blue Sky at Monster Made Pod in case Twitter goes tits up. We're also on Instagram and Facebook at The Monsters That Made Us. You can follow me pretty much everywhere at Dan Cologne. Mike, where can listeners find you?
You can find me everywhere at @_Mikester. That's MIKESTIR. And you can find all the other shows I'm on at cageclub.me.
I want to give a quick shout out to Steve and Daryl for becoming a Patreon supporter. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we have a Patreon. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to support the show, you too can be a Patreon supporter just like Steven. Just go to patreon.com/themonstersthatmadeus. You can also support the show by giving us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes. We love hearing from you guys that way. Leaving the reviews on iTunes helps more people discover the show. So please, if you love the show, please let us know and let others know by reviewing the show there. And we can't forget about our t-shirts on TeePublic. You can find the link for that in our aforementioned Twitter and Instagram bios. For all other things Cage Club related, just head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. Stay spooky, everybody.